Hello again to everybody. My name is Paul Weber, and I am pleased to welcome you to the teleclass lecture, Healthcare Workplaces from Discord to Patient-Centered. Our faculty today is Dr. Erwin Rubin. Irv is president of Temenos, Inc. and the Temenos Foundation in Honolulu. During his remarkable career, he has been a distinguished lecturer at the Sloan School of Management, at Harvard University, and at MIT. For the past three decades, his work has focused on working with healthcare organizations, and he first came to my attention last year when he published a fantastic article titled Healthcare Organizations as Patients, Transforming the Fundamental Organizational Development Paradigm. He has many other publications that have received wide acclaim, including a book titled My Pulse is Not What It Used to Be, The Leadership Challenges in Healthcare. In 1985, Irv was elected the first honorary non-physician member of the American College of Physician Executives. He has consulted with healthcare organizations in the United States, in Australia, and New Zealand, and for the next hour, he is all ours. I am pleased to present from spectacular Honolulu, Hawaii, the equally spectacular Dr. Erwin Rubin. Irv.
Thank you, Paul. In Hawaii, we get what we call chicken skin. Most people call that goosebumps around the world. And so I thank you very much for that wonderful, warm introduction. It gave me a little bit of that feeling. I'm really looking forward to sharing whatever experience and strength I've been able to develop over the years of being with healthcare with those of you around the world, and hope that you're able to put it to some use in dealing with the challenges that we face, all of us, on a day-to-day basis. So I'm going to let you flip from the first cover page that you have and take a look at the very first slide that says, physician leaders can be unique if, and I really mean that to be all leaders. So let me begin with a little story. A physician colleague that I met when I first started to work with the American College of Physician Executives, a gentleman named Dr. Ray Fernandez. Ray and I became very good friends, very good colleagues. He was a client of mine for a period of time when he was at the NAHL clinic. And he went from being a full-time physician to being the head of the Department of Urology to being part-time medical director, full-time medical director, and ultimately he was offered the opportunity to be the CEO of the NAHL clinic. And I knew that was a very difficult decision for him to make because, like many of you, I suspect, who are on the call today, Ray was trained to be a physician and loved taking care of patients. But he nonetheless did that, took over the job of CEO, and we stayed in close touch with one another. One day I happened to be in his city visiting another client, and I just dropped by his office spontaneously about 11:30 one morning, and I said, Ray, come on, I'll take you to lunch. He said, I'd love that, Irv. Give me a minute. I have to dictate some notes into a medical record. And I looked at him. I was startled. I said, Ray, you haven't seen patients for 4 or 5 years now. I don't understand what you're telling me. To make a long story short, in order to feel okay in his heart about becoming a chief executive and no longer seeing patients on a day-to-day basis, Ray Fernandez had used and taken all of the principles he learned as a physician and transferred them to the mindset of being the attending physician for a patient called the NAHL clinic. And lo and behold, if he didn't dictate notes on a weekly basis into a file and put them in his bottom right-hand drawer, and that file ultimately became a book that Ray and I wrote that Paul mentioned called My Pulse is Not What It Used to Be, and it's written as if it were a medical record for a patient called the NAHL clinic. So what did I learn from that? I learned that there were three very important facts that I believe have to be embraced if we are going to move from discord to patient-centered care, because I really believe a significant amount of the discord that we continue to struggle with stems from a failure to accept and embrace three facts. One, that an organization is itself a living, breathing human organism, a patient itself, As such, it requires TLC, tender love and care, and that the quality of the care that entity receives directly impacts the quality of care that a patient in the treatment room receives. So during our session today, I'm going to try to talk a little bit about some treatment tools that can be used by leaders who accept and embrace those facts. During the session, I'll mention several other references that Paul, I know, will be happy to get for you. And I will try to intersperse hard data where I believe it will be useful, and mostly common sense, because I think what we're struggling with is making common sense common practice. So, flipping now, let me give you an example of what happens, one example, when we fail to embrace these consequences, these facts. So imagine the following scenario, which takes place on a frightfully regular basis. A group of senior executives, senior managers, arrive to work one Monday morning at a hospital early because there are fewer of them and a lot to do, and several of them are met at the front door by a security guard. They are walked to their offices. They are given an hour or two to clean out their personal belongings. They are then walked back to the entrance to the hospital. Their entry passes are taken away from them, their badges. They have been laid off. They have been cut from the organization in an attempt to save budgets, which are getting very, very tight. That very situation was one that I happened to be experienced with a client that I was working with, and I asked the chief executive, upon what basis did she make such a preemptive move? Because no one knew this was coming. And she said, "Irv, we thought if we let information out, it would make too many people too anxious. So we kept it as close as we could within the board and then did it this way." Now, I know she had good intentions for that, but let me tell you what can easily happen in a situation like that. Word goes through the organization like wildfire. Layoffs are being made. People are getting pink slips. Imagine yourself being a nurse in an emergency room, and you happen to see a security guard wander by the door. That person may, in fact, be looking for the loo. You don't know that, but in that split second of distraction and anxiety, your eye moves from the patient to the door. It is not unlikely that you end up doing something medically that may not have been necessary or appropriate at that moment. You give a needle that is inappropriate. You miss. Something happens. And hopefully you can correct it then and there. Hopefully it gets reported as a near miss, which doesn't always happen. But what we're seeing there is an example of what I would call medical malpractice potential as a result of managerial malpractice. Managerial malpractice causing an anxiety between people in the ER. So the research I've tried to share with you here basically asks the question, or addressed the question, did it make a difference? Does it make a difference to which ER you're taken when you have a life-threatening illness? And this study is based on over 5,000 patients. And the answer is absolutely yes. If you were taken to one of the quote-unquote better emergency rooms, you had a 60% higher chance of surviving your condition than if you happen to be taken to one of the not good emergency rooms where you had a 58% higher probability of dying as a result of the condition. And the researchers came to only one conclusion that they could support, that the differences appeared to relate to the quality of the interaction and the communication between the physicians and the nurses. Let me turn next, potential managerial malpractice quiz. So I leave this with you. I won't say a lot about it, but I offer it to you as an opportunity to sit with your senior executives and simply talk about the items here. Because the extent to which you cannot say all of these items are true in your organization, that is the extent to which you may be liable and subject to the consequences of managerial malpractice and its impact on the quality of care and the kind of discord that may exist in your organization. So the key words are common behavioral code, everyone gets a performance review, both technical and interpersonal competencies are measured, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, switching to the next slide, many organizations would fail this quiz. Many of them would fail it. So as a result, in the vernacular of our space program, Houston, we have a problem. Healthcare is in trouble. Malpractice and or the threat of it is really destroying healthcare, at least in our experience here. I'm sure in Canada it's a potentially quite different story for you, but so many resources are going into protecting against malpractice suits. And indeed, there's growing data that suggests the tests are being done to try to protect against subsequent malpractice suits that themselves may in fact be having a negative impact on the quality of patient care. Tens of thousands of people are dying from treatment in our hospitals unrelated to their admitting condition. The data that I've seen that I think is publicly available is that the single most frequent condition resulting in the death of a patient is being admitted to the hospital. Is being admitted to a hospital for care of another condition. Someone equated that number to a 767 jumbo jet crashing and burning and killing every passenger aboard it every single day for 1 year. I don't know how many of you fly, but a 767 jumbo jet holds approximately 300 some odd people. So we have a conservative estimate of in excess of 100,000 people dying daily from the treatment that they receive for other conditions in our hospitals. Untold numbers of near misses go unreported, and good nurses are very hard to find and very hard to keep. So I believe, if we move to the next slide, that we need a new conceptual piece to our puzzle if we are going to better manage discord in the organization. We are doing an incredible job of improving the technical effectiveness of the care that patients receive. We are increasingly doing an extraordinary job on improving the managerial efficiency of the organizations. Excuse me one sec. That leaves us, I believe, at the moment with quality management in healthcare sitting atop a two-legged stool. And I don't know how many of you would have tried to stand on a two-legged stool, but it's reasonably unstable, and you have to be very careful where you put your weight. We are missing a leg, and I'm going to define that leg or ask you to think about that leg as behavioral quality assurance. And putting that leg underneath our total quality management stool will require significant leadership from people like yourselves who happen to be listening to the program today. So let me distinguish quality assurance, behavioral quality assurance, from traditional quality assurance by flipping to the next page. If we look at the function of medicine, the science of medicine, its primary function is curing disease. That is the focus of traditional quality assurance. When we have done the superior job we continue to strive to do in curing illness, we can say yes to the question, have the hard technologies and science of medicine been appropriately and skillfully applied in the service of curing? If yes, check, done extremely well on traditional quality assurance. That's one of the main things, obviously, that JACO looks at when it makes a visit to a hospital. Are you doing good medicine? Healing, however, is quite different, I believe. Healing has to do with the art of medicine, and that is the focus of behavioral quality assurance. Healing asks the question, have all, and I put all in big letters, the hands that have been laid upon patients been appropriately and skillfully applied in the service of healing? So what we've got in total quality assurance is we're looking for a way of getting both high-tech and high-touch. And I believe we have not yet made them equal in terms of importance, and that's where the leadership potential is available with respect to behavioral quality assurance. So let me give you an example of what that means in from my own experience. If you flip over, you'll see a picture of a quite formally dressed young Japanese person. I was telling Paul when we, excuse me, one second, I do have a frog. I need to take a sip of water. I was telling Paul before we began that I have what we call in Hawaii tuhapa grandchildren. They're half Caucasian, half Japanese. And in visiting them one year when they were born early in their lives in Japan, my daughter, knowing that I had an interest in healthcare, arranged for me to go to visit a small hospital nearby where they lived in Chiba, a place called St. Marguerite's Hospital. And as we drove up to the front door of the hospital, a person dressed in clothing not unlike the woman you see in the picture was at the front door to greet us. Now, this was many years ago, and I'm sorry to admit that my ego was higher and bigger then than I hope it is today. And my first thought was, isn't that sweet? Isn't that traditionally Japanese? They are making a special effort to treat and welcome a visitor from a foreign country. And this person opened the door and gave me her hand and led me to the entryway, and then we walked into the hospital. It didn't take very long for me to be educated to the fact that this person, A, was a nurse, B, had been a nurse in that hospital for in excess of 20 years, and as a reward, as an honor for that length of service, she, in fact, was at the front door all the time because they understood that the healing process for patients begins when they arrive at the hospital. And because they received her hand, they believed that they were contributing positively to the healing process. Now, I don't know what it's like in your hospital, but when I arrive in my hospital here in Hawaii, more often than not, the first hand that I see wants a couple of dollars to park my car. If I make a phone call in to try to check on something, I get wonderfully sweet recorded announcements telling me how important I am as a person to push this number or that number. And very often, by the time I actually get to the provider that I'm trying to talk to, there's a bit of me that's a little bit angry and a little bit upset and a little bit frustrated. And the plaque outside the hospital in St. Marguerite's says that we will heal sometimes, we will support often, and we will comfort always. I believe that's an example of an institution that understands the difference and the parallelism between high tech and high touch. So let me give you a snapshot of just some of the data upon which the points I'm making rest. So if you flip, you'll see a triangle. In the bottom left-hand corner, it says nursing turnover. On the top, it says length of stay. And on the bottom right-hand corner, it says organizational culture. What I'm doing here is summarizing two studies. One was published in 1964, and I'll say a word about the old date in a moment, by Reginald Revens. And it was entitled Standards for Morale, Cause and Effect in Hospitals, Oxford University Press. Dr. George Salmond, if we have anybody on from New Zealand, they will recognize that name immediately. I met George many, many years ago, and when I met him, he was the Minister of Health. New Zealand is a small country, and the Minister of Health is a big position in any country. So George was at the time the highest-ranking physician in the country, and access, obviously, to a huge amount of data on the hospitals and the system. George took it upon himself to try to replicate Revens' study from 1964, and he published that in a paper called A Comparative Study of Disease-Specific Length of Stay in New Zealand Hospitals. He was basically interested in the question, does it make a difference what hospital you are admitted to in New Zealand? Does it have an impact on the length of stay that you experience in a couple of medical categories like asthma and diabetes and gastric duodenal ulcers, and a couple of surgical categories like hernia, appendicitis, and varicose veins. And the answer was absolutely yes, there was a significant difference, and that was independent of hospital size, which meant that the rich hospitals were not doing better, and the more highly equipped hospitals were not doing better in those medical and surgical areas than some of the smaller country hospitals. He had two other pieces of data. He had data on nursing turnover, and he had data which he specifically went to get because he wanted, as I said, to replicate the Revan study on what I'm calling organization culture. He was basically able to get questionnaires filled out by employees in each of these hospitals, and those questionnaires focused specifically on their perception of the quality of the relationship among and between themselves as staff. So that's an example of what I would call behavioral quality assurance. How healthy was the interaction? How caring was the interaction amongst all the staff members? Keep in mind that they were not being asked how they felt they cared for patients. They were being asked how they felt they cared for one another. And there was, and I believe still is, an extraordinarily powerful statistical correlation between nursing turnover, length of stay, and organizational culture. So the nursing turnover is like what we're calling now magnet hospitals. In those hospitals, in George's study and in the Revan study, where nurses could not wait to leave, if you'll pardon me putting it this way, patients had difficulty being discharged. And in those hospitals where nurses were magnetically attracted to staying at the hospital, patients were being released from medical and surgical procedures more rapidly. The same thing happened with organization culture. The healthier the organization culture, the more nurses stayed, the lower the turnover. The more diseased the organization culture, the more likely nurses were to leave. And here's the part that really got me, and I hope it gets your attention: the quality of the relationships amongst and between all staff members was directly correlated with length of patient stay. So let me come back to the dates, because people look at that and say, that's old data. Don't you have anything new? And there is new data, and it's available. But I partly wanted to show you old data because I'd like us to think about, why is it that we have this information available to us, and we seem, at least in my knowledge, not have been able to use it to the positive advantage yet of managing discord. And I asked George Salmon the same question. I said, George, you are the Minister of Health. You have a position of power in this country. Why can you not, in effect, make these results work in the hospitals? And what he said to me with a very sad and chagrined look on his face, he said, Irv, I seem unable to get my physician colleagues to take personal responsibility for the impact of their day-to-day behavior. That is a comment I will return to in a little while. So let's zoom in quickly on the nurses, because they are the point of TLC. I'll quickly give you the results of one of many, many studies of this kind, actually too many studies of this kind. This one's based on in excess of 2,500 nurses, and these are examples with frequency of the kind of disruptive behaviors they witnessed or experienced, the kind of discord: condescension, disrespect, abusive anger, abusive language, being berated by patients, physical abuse, which more often than not was fortunately not hand physical, but the throwing of a chart across a room, not unfamiliar to many of you, I'm sure. And very importantly, these kinds of behaviors were not always, and I want to underscore, not always perpetrated by physicians. Nurses, as many of you know, have the great capability to eat their own young periodically. How often does that happen? The results of this study point out that it can happen as frequently as 30%. 30% can report that it happens weekly or daily. Now, that's a phenomenal number when you think of the size of the sample. And when you talk with the nurses who've experienced that, they'll say things like, well, you got to be thick-skinned around here. You get used to it. That's just how he or she is. And I ask you again to think about the relationship between managerial malpractice and medical malpractice, because for myself, the last thing I want is a nurse sitting by my bedside or the bedside of one of my loved ones who is thick-skinned. I want a nurse sitting by that bedside who's ultra-sensitive to what might be going on with me. So who are the perpetrators? It's a small number that exhibit over 70% of the disruptive behaviors. The frightening thing about that is, number one, they have a huge impact, and secondly, they are invariably known to everyone. It is not a surprise when somebody is a habitual perpetrator of unhealthy behavior towards other colleagues. And so people in the rest of the organization have to ask themselves the question, why is this being allowed to happen if we all know? And in some cases, it's fear, because I hate to say this as a stereotype, but sometimes the perpetrators are amongst the highest income generators, so they're basically holding the organization hostage. The organization, by not acting, sends a message to others that they condone that behavior, which increases the likelihood of it happening. But most importantly, if we think about the organization as a living, breathing human organism, knowing where the cancer is and not acting to do anything about that cancer basically sends a signal to that human organism that we don't care about you. I wish I could say, if you flip over, that this is just an American disease, and it's not. Here's a snapshot of data collected in the UK in 2003, sample size in excess of 300, and you'll see on that bar graph that, again, approximately one-third of the people who responded said that they experienced verbal abuse at least weekly or more often. I was getting to wonder, since the 33% thereabouts is so constant across different samples, I thought we were maybe dealing with something genetic in that regard, but it looks like it's more profession-based than country-based, at least at the moment. So turn with me for a moment so we can start to look at some tools that you might be able to use to try to keep in mind that you're dealing with a human organism, a patient in need of care, and that you're trying to act to minimize the discord. So the tools I'd like to share with you are tools that parallel and mirror things that you might do with patients at the individual level, but we're looking for ones that might be used at the organizational level that embrace and implement the three facts we looked at in our first slide. So the first one will be one I call the VSAT, the Vital Signs Assessment Tool. A second one will be called the Organizational Excellence Survey, and I will equate it to an MRI. A third will be called the Patient-Defined Experience Measurement Tool. And the final one will be called the Behavior Minder, which will help us look at the issue of leading by example. So let's look a little bit at the VSAT, which I consider to be an example of continuous quality improvement at the bedside level. Probably these days it's done more by computer than by a clipboard hanging at the edge of the bed, but I suspect there are still places where there's a clipboard available as well. What does that clipboard provide me as a provider of healthcare? I can walk into the room as a physician or a nurse and get an immediate snapshot of the current state of health of the patient lying in that bed. If all the vital signs are as they should be, I'm grateful, the patient is grateful, and nothing of an urgent nature or different nature needs to be done, the healing process and the curing process are taking place as hoped. The VSAT measures something that's has to do with continuous quality improvement at the organization level and provides a comparable snapshot. We will see that it will give us a picture of the confidence that people have in the quality of care technically provided by their colleagues, in their loyalty to their own organization, again, in the extent of verbal abuse that is experienced, the extent to which there is a hardening of the arteries in the organization. Is the blood flowing smoothly, or are there blockages that have to be dealt with in some way? And what about leadership integrity? What does the spinal column of this organization look like at the moment, since it is the spinal column that carries all of the nerve endings that make the system sensitive to what's going on? So if you flip the page, I've pulled from my files one example of the results that a vital signs assessment tool generated in one organization. This was a relatively small hospital, so I have a 100% sample. The director of the hospital, in effect, required everybody fill it out. So I have it from the boardroom down to the individual whose responsibility it was to keep the floors clean. And if you look at question one, what it says, in effect, is you're away from home, a loved one of yours is being rushed to the institution with a life-threatening illness. How likely would it be that the first thought that flashed through your mind, that one of the prayers that came through your mind immediately would be, God, I hope so-and-so, and you have a particular person or person in your mind, is not on duty when they arrive because I'm away and I can't be certain to honcho them through the system. They are like any other patient coming in off the street. They will be taken care of by the luck of the draw. How likely is it that you would have that thought? And as you look at the data, you can see that almost 1 in 5, 21% of every single employee in this organization said they would be very likely or likely to have a degree of anxiety about who it was amongst their professional colleagues that was on duty to take care of their loved one. When you add in the somewhat likely, you end up with 45% of this hospital has anxiety about the technical quality of the care that a loved one of theirs would get if they were not there to somehow try to intervene. You then look at question two, which asks the question, in effect, of loyalty. Now you've got a dear friend who's thinking of applying for a job at this hospital. What kind of advice would you give them? And almost two-thirds would say to that person, go for it. And that snapped my head a little bit, particularly when I went down to the third question, which had to do with verbal abuse. And in this case, the way I defined verbal abuse was to speak, as you can see, to speak insultingly or harshly to or about someone. In Hawaii, we call it talking stink. It's one thing to talk to your face and be verbally abusive. It's another thing to poison your reputation with somebody else. And in this case, I thought both of them were poisoning the bloodstream of the organizational system. And here you see that 30% of this organization could say that they experienced that or saw that more than once per week or almost daily. If you add in the once per week respondents, you get 45%. And I flashed back in my own mind to the nurse's data. So let me put those three bits of information together in what to me is absolute insanity. If a patient came to you as a provider and said, doctor, nurse, the people I'm living with make me feel like my life is being threatened. Not only that, they verbally abuse me all the time. You might say to them, why do you stay? And that person would say, because I love them. I'm going to stay with them. And I hope you can see the insanity of that. What I'd be saying to a dear friend of mine is, hey, come on and work here. Come on and take that job. Heck, it's only going to cost you verbal abuse on a regular basis. And you'll have to be praying a lot if somebody that you love comes into the hospital for care and you're not around. But what the heck? Come get the job anyway. I call that lunacy. If you flip over to the remainder of the data, you can see that in terms of the hardening of the arteries, the organization is experiencing a dangerous level of potential hardening of the arteries, and that would link back to their managerial malpractice quiz, where there's a lot of messengers that have been killed in this organization. Not surprisingly, their organizational integrity, their spiritual strength, is equally shaky. So let me flip now. So if you were, again, a provider, and you'd seen vital signs data that made you as nervous as that data should make you if you're thinking about the organization as a patient, you would have to take steps to get more intrusive and more extensive diagnostics done. And that's where I reach out myself for what I call the Organizational Excellence Survey that provides an MRI behind the VSAT. Culture, in my simple ex-engineering mindset, I see now as a consequence. I see it as an outcome of the day-to-day choices people make about how they behave. And once a culture forms in an organization, it has one and only one primary purpose, which is to reinforce itself. So people are given all kinds of subtle signals about what constitutes appropriate behavior in the organization, unwritten rules about behavior, and anybody who violates those cultural norms on a regular basis gets excommunicated, either literally or figuratively. So I like the spinal column there, because the spinal column is to the human being what an organization's culture is to the organization itself. It's what gives it stability. It's where all of its nerve endings are. It is the backbone of the organization. I have come to believe and realize that values themselves cannot be managed. Only behavior can be managed. Many organizations take a very important first step and come up with value statements. But if those values are not translated into operational behaviors, you can end up with a significant amount of discord and not know why. For example, if I were to ask, and I've done this many times, 100 people to give me an example of a behavior, an observable behavior, that another person needs to exhibit for them to conclude they have been respected by that person, the probability of those 100 people giving me the same exact answer behaviorally is zero. It is absolutely zero. So we agree at the value level. Our discord is coming because we have not yet had the opportunity for a discussion or a mechanism that allows us to understand what that translates into behavior and then agree to behave towards one another in that way. So the Organizational Excellence Survey that I'll give you a snapshot of momentarily has 48 behaviors in it, and the criteria that I use for selecting those behaviors is the same criteria you would use if you were a provider in putting together a patient treatment protocol. It's based on hard data, and a lot of that hard data goes as far back as the Revens Salmon research, where they were asking people to make comments on how frequently they perceived the staff treated one another in certain ways. So let me give you an example of what happens when you use a tool like this. So imagine that we've got 48 behaviors, and I'll show you some examples in a moment. I would ask people the following question. So we're going to zoom in now. That's why I called it an MRI. The VSAT has concerns. It looks like it has a lot of verbal abuse, and we need to dig down into some of the root causes of what's going on here. So I'd ask people two questions. Think about the people with whom you interact on a regular basis. How much importance do they seem to attribute currently to each of the 48 behaviors in the Organizational Excellence Survey? How much importance, then they go through a second time, how much importance should be attributed to each of those behaviors if your organization is to achieve excellence in patient care, which every organization says it strives to do? And what I do is I take those sets of responses and I create what I call a delta. A delta is the difference between the percentage of people who say that a particular behavior should be treated very importantly minus the percentage of people who say that same behavior is currently being treated very importantly. So the bigger the delta, the bigger the difference between the should be and the currently, the bigger is the gap between what an organization believes and agrees it needs to do to create a certain culture and the current culture that it currently is living with. So if you turn to the next page, I've given you a very small snapshot because I don't want to overburden us with data at this point. There are several papers that if people want, they can contact Paul and I can make available to you. But here are some examples of the behaviors that are in that pool. We focus on what we can learn from this mistake, not who is to blame. We gracefully accept feedback, admit our mistakes, so on. We pay careful attention without interrupting when people are trying to make a point, and we remain patient and receptive. In organization A, you can see that the deltas, the discrepancy between the should be and the currently, range in this sample from a delta of 60%, which is not insignificant, to a low of 28%. The 60% in this case is referring to an item that talks about who is to blame versus what we can learn. Notice in organization B that the delta on that very same behavior is almost 100%. Again, what that means is that the organization was in perfect, almost perfect agreement on how important it is to not look for scapegoats. And they were equally almost in 100% agreement that looking for scapegoats, looking for who to blame, is a very typical pattern in that organization. Please reflect on the consequence of that dynamic alone on a person's willingness to admit a near miss in the organization. When you go down to the next to the bottom one, where in organization A, they seem to be doing a much better job of meeting their own standard of paying careful attention than in organization B, it should come as no surprise that in organization B, when you look at patient satisfaction scores, a huge number of patients complained that the staff did not take enough time to listen to them. And that's to be predicted, because that particular cultural dynamic is winding its way through the bloodstream of the organization. So a final word about organization B. They got very defensive when I presented them that data. They actually were so in such a state of denial that they made snide efforts to shoot the messenger and joked with me about how long it must have taken me to put down and answer all of the questions. And 4 weeks after I presented them the data and they put it on the shelf and decided to do nothing about it, they suffered a 2-week nurses' strike. The nurses got demagnetized and they could stand it no longer. They left. So let me give you an example now of another organization. So this is a study that was done at a hospital called Carondelet. It's a faith-based organization in Kansas City. And they decided to use the Organizational Excellence Survey as well. And they decided to actually do something about it. So in 2001, they administered the Organizational Excellence Survey to the entire organization. And you see an example of some of the deltas that they were experiencing in 2001. They were quite high and of concern, as should be appropriate, to senior managers. They then implemented a systematic culture change effort. They didn't just put the data up on a shelf. And the culture change effort is based on the premise that the way we get the culture currently is that people are making day-to-day choices about how to behave towards one another. And if the culture is going to be different at a point down the road, people are going to have to make different choices about how they behave towards one another, and they need support in learning those behaviors. So at the simplest level, what I'm saying is culture change is a phrase that's being thrown around in a lot of organizations these days because it's an important topic. But if you cannot document a change in observable day-to-day behavioral patterns at point 2 in time in the future compared to point 1 in time in the future, then in no way, shape, or form do I believe you can say you have experienced a change in culture. And you can see between 2001 and 2004, Caron Dillett, in fact, seemed to be having some success. When you flip to the next page, they still have a lot of work to do. There were behaviors that they did not experience as much change that were of high importance in 2001, so they were continuing to work. The important thing in their case, and I believe in any such case, was that none of the deltas in 2004 were bigger than they had in 2001. So let's take this down a level to what I'd call where the rubber meets the road, patient-centered. One of my clients is the Veterans Administration here. Veterans Administration is experiencing or facing what I would call a life-and-death challenge on the horizon. By the year 2014, veterans in the United States will have the opportunity to choose where they go to get their health care. Right now, they must go to a veteran hospital or pay for it out of pocket. By 2014, they will be able to go to any hospital to get health care. It will be paid for out of their veterans' benefits. So if you're a director of a VA hospital, you have to be very, very aware of the fact that your hospital has the opportunity or has the potential of dying if you cannot get veterans answering yes to the question, if you could get free health care anywhere else, how likely it would be that you would choose this hospital? That is a question they ask on a regular basis in their surveys. We have researched that question, and the single most important correlate within their database driving a positive answer to that question is the patient reporting that they felt cared for as a person by their nurse and their doctor. And I underscore person. They're not talking about being treated as a member of a focus group. They're talking about being cared for as a person by their providers. And I want to remind us before I even mention how the kind of study we're doing that I believe when we're talking about caring for patients as people, we want to remind ourselves of the Revens and Salmon data that we're not just talking about a marketing orientation to attract patients, to quote-unquote make sales, but we're also talking about quality care. We're talking about length of patient stay. So it's a yes and, not an either-or. So there's an experiment in process, and it's called Patient-Defined Experience Measurement, PDEM. And again, there's a paper that Paul will be happy to make available to you or put you in touch with me to make available that will give you some of the details of that. And it's based on the notion and the research data that we've gotten from the VA. So what you see here is a nurse standing next to a patient taking some notes. And here's how the process works, if you'll turn to the next page. In the VA, they call it the VIP project, Veterans Interpersonal Preferences. So you are a patient. You are being admitted to a surgical floor, which is where we're doing the pilot right now. And the nurse is taking all of the information needed about you and your medical history and so on and so forth. And the last thing the nurse does before that intake process is completed is hand you a sheet of paper that has the information you see in front of you right now. And it basically says our objective is to make certain you get the highest quality medical care possible, but we also want you to feel cared for as a person. And because we know that that means different things to different people, we need your help. We need to know what it means to you as an individual person, as a single patient, to conclude you have been cared for. And so 10 items are listed below, and you're asked to pick 2 or 3 that you would like to have part of your treatment plan while you're here. Now, those behaviors that you see there are by conscious design taken from and adapted from the 48 that are trickling its way through the rest of the organization. So we end up with one integrated behavioral spinal column, and all we've done is refocus that to make it relevant at the patient level. And so you as a patient pick two or three of those, and then if you flip over, you see what happens is that the nurse can reach into that little red box at the bottom of that piece that hangs on every wall. It's a whiteboard that hangs on the wall by every patient's bed. And after filling out the other medical information, attending physician and so on, the nurse reaches into that red container, pulls out which of the two or three behaviors that the patient selected, they're on big pieces of Velcro, and puts them in the spot marked VIP. And in doing so, every single person who comes in and has contact with the patient is reminded what behaviors that patient needed in order for them to feel cared for as a person. And I think in doing this, what we actually are taking a giant step towards creating is a true partnership between patient and provider. The provider is responsible for the technical quality of the care, and the patient is now stepping up to the responsibility to define what they mean when they say human quality of care. Ultimately, we expect that this information will be put into the patient's medical record and will follow the patient around so that, for example, when they come back for a follow-up visit, they are able to call the scheduling secretary in the Department of Orthopedics. And when that person types in this case, the last four digits of their Social Security number, the same behaviors will show up in the upper right-hand corner of their medical record. And I know this sounds in some ways very complicated, or maybe not, but I'd like to remind all of us, for example, that if I pick up the phone today and I call Pizza Hut around the corner from where I live and I give them my telephone number, which they will have immediately because they'll be able to read it, the first thing I will hear from the person who answers the phone is, "Hello, Mr. Rubin, would you still like your pizza with the pepperoni on top or not?" In other words, they have kept track of my preference in their system. And if Pizza Hut can do that, and the Ritz-Carlton can do that, certainly my healthcare provider can do that. So let's flip over to the next one, because we are now moving into what it is that a challenge that everybody faces in leading by example in the care of the patient organization. So you see a person looking in a mirror, shaving, and I picked that image for a couple of reasons. One, it reminds me of an interaction my wife and I had where we met up with the chief of a Maasai village. And after Nan got through drawing pictures of the children, sketch pictures, he came over and through his son asked for the same thing to be done for him. Nan was a little bit more nervous, but she drew the picture and in so doing gave it to him. And when he looked at it, I could tell he was not very, very happy at all. Well, to make a long story short, as we understood from his son, he had never in his lifetime seen a reflection of his face. He lived in an area, in a community, in a tribe where there were no mirrors. So he knew he had no front teeth as a matter of physical experience. But he had never seen a picture of it, and he thought Nan was making fun of him. Well, when his son explained no, that she was simply giving him her perception of what he looked like, he got as excited as the children and started to run around the community. So the reason why I bring this in here is that if you look at the words listed to the left of the picture that you're looking at right now, those are amongst the most frequently used words when people are having conversations around conflict and around problems. And missing by their conspicuous, by their absence, are the words I and me. We have a tendency not to take personal responsibility for our behavior, and that's the point that Dr. Salmon was making in the earlier research that I quoted for you. So that leads me, if you turn the page, to what I call continuous quality improvement at the individual level. Many of you, I'm sure, are very familiar with traditional 360s. They are anonymous. They are based on aggregated data. They often are based on attitudes and values as opposed to behaviors. They can be very judgmental, good or bad, and the recipient of the feedback is often left not knowing what to do. I find those kinds of feedback instruments to be not only not helpful, but sometimes dysfunctional. As an alternative, I would offer you the opportunity to take a look on our web at something called Behavior Minder. It is a non-anonymous, one-on-one, relationship calibration tool. The behaviors in the Behavior Minder parallel those that are focused on in my own work on culture. You get an opportunity to get feedback on not only how frequently you are exhibiting those behaviors, but whether somebody would like you to do more of them, less of them, or the same of them. And you have immediate opportunities for action, A, because you know who it is that's asking you or giving you the feedback, and secondly, because you know what it is that, from their point of view, would strengthen the relationship. If you're interested in more detail on that, you can take a look at a book I wrote with a physician colleague, Dr. Tom Campbell, called The ABCs of Effective Feedback, A Guide for Caring Professionals. So let me bring us to the last two. Rehumanizing healthcare workplaces from patient discord to patient-centered care. I believe that the way to do this is to extend your organization's patient care oath at the individual patient level to a patient care oath at the organizational level. To first do no harm, and secondly, to first heal thyself. The first do no harm, in fact, is the title of a docudrama that a physician colleague and I are in the process of trying to create right now. And if any of you have interest in learning more about that, please feel free to contact me. But what I'm suggesting here is that the principles of excellent patient care at the individual level can, in fact, be extended to caring for the patient organization that cares for the individual patient, and in so doing, discord will drop significantly. So the final piece, final PowerPoint is listed. It's called the rewards. Douglas McGregor is a name many of you may know. I was blessed to have him as one of my faculty advisors. He wrote a book called The Human Side of Enterprise. And one day, Doug was talking with his young faculty colleagues, and he made a comment that was very, very profound, and I'll never forget it. He said, "There is a part of me that feels phony in my conversations with my chief executive clients." And he went on to explain that as he talked with them, he would talk with them about the importance of treating their employees well, but in order to get their attention and not turn them away, he always spoke of that in extrinsic terms. If you treat them well, morale will be higher, productivity will be higher, and so on. He said, when the fact of the matter is, and he would reach over and touch his heart at that point in time, he said, the fact of the matter is, I believe that the reason why people should be treated well is because they are miracles of creation. In other words, he believed in that principle for intrinsic reasons, not extrinsic reasons. And if we did it for the intrinsic reason that was the truth, everything else would take care of itself. So the very last piece there is the final line in Dr. Fernandez's book, My Pulse, which, as you remember from the beginning of our time together, has had such a profound effect on me and my thinking about the organization as a living, breathing human organism. And the last line in the second edition of that book says, by embracing the essential oneness of patient care, with a small p, and patient care, with a big P, the healthcare industry has the opportunity to contribute to the health of the nation. Thank you so very much again for taking the time from your busy schedules to be with us today. Mahalo.
Thank you very much. I see you put on your last slide there your contact information, and if people have questions regarding the docudrama that you're working on, is it okay if they contact you directly at the email mentioned there?
Please do that, and if there are any wishes for some of the references, I'd be happy to provide those, so they can either send me an email directly or send it through to you.
Well, that's fantastic. It's really been a very interesting teleclass. I've really particularly enjoyed the way you take something that's very subjective in terms of how people want to be treated and almost turn it into something that's objective. And, of course, it's all the objective things that hospital administrators want to deal with. They don't really, presuming anyway, they don't want to deal with anything subjective. They want to deal with the data, the objective things, right?
Yes, they do, and I think that's very positive and very important. And the data is very clear. That's why the the research I quoted from Salmon is so important, A, because it's old, but B, because the situation hasn't changed. It's not that we don't know what to do. The question is, do we have the courage to do what we know needs to be done?
Well, thank you again very much. And to all of those who are listening, either live or by recording, thank you for joining us, for supporting Teleclass Education, and we will look forward to meeting with you again very soon. Goodbye.
Terrific. Thank you so much.